O'Flaherty, and welcome to All About Jack, a podcast feature of EssentialCSLewis.com. On the program today, I'm continuing to celebrate the fact that 2015 is the 65th anniversary of the publication of the first Narnia story. I do that on this show by re-releasing a special series I did in 2012 with Dr. Michael Ward that focused on his book, The Narnia Code. Dr. Holly Ordway was my co-host for it. If you heard those shows when they came out, you know I did 13 episodes, one for each chapter of the book, and a special final program to address common questions raised about Dr. Ward's material. However, for this special posting, I'm combining several of the shows so they are only divided into 5 parts. This first show groups the initial 3 podcasts because Dr. Ward devotes the first 3 chapters laying the groundwork for his revolutionary perspective. As you might recall, I've previously done a single podcast on the book and even re-released it not that long ago. While Dr. Michael Ward was available by Skype when we recorded, at the time I was still learning how to adjust my settings for recording, and so while you should have no problem hearing him or Holly, I still wished it was even a better audio quality. Also worth noting is the fact that most of the original shows were only between 15 and 20 minutes long, and that's because while wanting to cover a good amount of material for each chapter, we still wanted to leave you with wanting more and wanting to thus read the book itself. Additionally, I edited out the ending to the first and second show and just provide transitional music to help make you aware the ending of the program to the start of the next. At the time I recorded these shows, Dr. Holly Ordway had just begun teaching at Houston Baptist University. I've also had her on the show many times since, including discussing her spiritual autobiography, Not God's Type. You can find a link to that in the show notes. I began the first episode by having Holly introduce herself, mostly by way of saying how she became interested in Dr. Ward's book. Then when I introduced Dr. Ward, I asked him what he hoped people would gain from his work.
Well, I'm a professor of English. That's my background, English and apologetics. I'm now working at Houston Baptist University. And I actually have been interested in the Chronicles of Narnia for a very long time, read them as a child and enjoyed them very much, and then actually did some work on them when I wrote my doctoral dissertation, and have always been interested in the structure of them and what's going on, and never really felt I had a satisfactory account of how they worked, although they definitely did. And so about a year or so ago, when I picked up Michael's book and read it and thought, well, actually very skeptical when I started out, thinking, you know, how can there be a code? I'm sure this is all a bunch of nonsense. And I'm going to review this, and I'm going to argue most vehemently that this doesn't work. And then as I read it, I got to about, I think it was about chapter 3 when I conceded defeat. And chapter 5, I put down my pencil, which I was hoping to do all these critiques with, and just settled in to enjoy the argument and found it really not just convincing, but really helpful, because I work with Lewis as an apologist and found that Planet Narnia and the idea of Donegality and the idea of how Lewis is using this imagery from the medieval cosmological system is really helpful to my own work. And so that really is why I'm so pleased to be able to talk about this with him.
One of the recent books I've written is The Narnia Code, which is the shorter, simpler version of Planet Narnia. And what I hope that people will get from both these books, really, is a greater awareness of C.S. Lewis's skill as a writer and how the Narnia Chronicles are even better and even more deeply, meaningfully Christian than we've previously understood them as being.
There's one final issue to address, and that is what order to read the Chronicles in.
I think very strongly that they should be read in the order that they were originally published, which is to say you should start with The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, not with The Magician's Nephew. The Magician's Nephew deals with, obviously, the earlier part of Narnian history. It deals with the Narnian creation, but that doesn't mean you should read it first. You should read it sixth, actually. That's where it was published, 6 out of 7. And it works much better as a kind of prequel or a flashback rather than the opening to the whole series. All sorts of reasons for that, but the most important, perhaps, is that when Lewis published The Magician's Nephew, he knew that most of his readers would have read five previous books and that they would therefore already be well acquainted with the character of Aslan. So he takes no particular pains to introduce Aslan in The Magician's Nephew, whereas in The Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe he does, because The Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe was the first published, and obviously none of his readers had come across this character Aslan at all. And he makes that very point in The Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe. When the children in the story first hear mention of this character, they react in various different ways, and the narrator then says, "The children knew no more about Aslan than you do, you the reader." Now, of course, that makes no sense at all if you're reading The Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe second, because you will already have encountered the character of Aslan. So that's just one reason. There are many other reasons why you should not read The Magician's Nephew first.
Yes, very much so. You should read them in the order that they were published. And, you know, it's true that you can reread them in any order that you like, and it can be really fun and interesting to reread them in internal chronological order as a different experience. But that's very different from the very first time you come to it. You can never have a first encounter for a second time. Once you've dipped into it in the middle, you can't have that freshness of experience again. And I think that freshness of experience is part of what makes The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe so engaging. When we go into Narnia with Lucy, we don't know what to expect. And that draws us in a really profound way. So yes, I would agree.
All right, well, on to chapter one, it's simply called The Mystery. While some may wonder why a person should consider trying to find a hidden meaning in The Chronicles of Narnia, it seems you describe that as a young boy, Michael, you noticed something unusual about the first story. Hearing your mother read The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe resulted in, you might say, a quest that ended up in the discovery you talk about in the Narnia Code. So what was that started this great Narnian mystery for you as that young boy?
Well, I was just perplexed by the appearance of Father Christmas in the story. That he, although I liked him being there, I was very glad when he turned up and gave the children their presents. I just felt it was a bit odd that he should appear. He's called Father Christmas. He's the embodiment of the festival of Christmas, the birth of Christ. Within the Narnian world, within the story, there is no recognition of a character called Christ. That was the odd thing. They have this Christ-like character called Aslan, yes, but they never call him Christ within Narnia. So what do they mean by Christmas? What do they mean by Father Christmas? Doesn't seem to make very good sense. So that was what made me think there was something slightly odd about this first Narnia story. And as I read on in the later books, there were other similar things too. For instance, the appearance of Bacchus in Prince Caspian. He seemed to be a very odd interpolation from a mythological tradition which didn't seem to be particularly well connected to the story otherwise. So that was, you know, at a very early age, I wouldn't have been able to articulate it in these terms. It was just a slight sense of discomfort, imaginatively speaking.
Right. Well, one of the things that gets tossed around a lot when talking about the Chronicles of Narnia is one of Lewis's good friends, J.R.R. Tolkien, had commented that the books were essentially planless, and that was his perception of them. But that does not seem the case. Am I right?
Well, that's the argument that I make, that they are very carefully planned much more carefully than we previously realized. But yes, that was Tolkien's response when C.S. Lewis read the first few chapters of The Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe to him while it was being written. Tolkien thought that it was a hodgepodge and a mishmash, so he couldn't understand why Lewis had put together all these seemingly incompatible mythological traditions. English children, centaurs and fauns and dryads, Father Christmas, the White Witch who seems to be very closely based on the Snow Queen character in a Hans Andersen fairy tale. And that was Tolkien's attitude, that he thought Lewis had just slopped these things together with no particular imaginative logic. And that attitude towards the books has, because of Tolkien's fame, has taken root and been quite widely accepted. The only problem with that attitude, when you begin to think about it a bit more reflectively, is that Lewis was not characteristically a random or a slapdash writer or thinker. He was very consistent and rigorous in his thinking. So it's not very likely, actually, that he would have written the books like that.
Well, in fact, you share a quote from Barfield that what he, Lewis, thought about everything was secretly present in what he said about anything.
Yes, I mean, that's a very interesting quote supporting this very point that I'm making, that Lewis was very consistent and rigorous and detailed in his thinking, and everything seemed to link up to everything else. Now, Tolkien didn't actually know the Narnia Chronicles very well. He soon gave up trying to read them, apparently, according to George Sayer. When the books began to be published, he didn't actually read them all. So his knowledge of them was relatively slight. And he, Tolkien, had such a very purist, almost obsessive view about the internal consistency of reality that a sub-created world should have, that it's hardly surprising that almost any work of fiction, actually, would have disappointed Tolkien on this score.
Yeah. One of the things that you do deal with in this chapter is the issue of if Lewis, or he's known by Jack to his friends, that's his nickname, if he did have a plan behind the story, how could he have kept it a secret from others? After all, wasn't he a straightforward person?
Well, he was, in many ways, straightforward and frank and open and honest, yes. But he was a very complex man, and he had another side to him too, which could be very guarded, very private, indeed occasionally secretive and even misleading when he thought there was good reason to be so. For instance, he got married in his late 50s, and he told no one that he'd got married for the best part of a year. You know, that's an extraordinary thing to do. Mm-hmm. Not even close friends like Tolkien were told that C.S. Lewis had got married. Now, I think a man who can keep a marriage secret can keep a secret about almost anything. But there are plenty of other examples, too, of his capacity for secretiveness. His autobiography, Surprised by Joy, left out so many important things that one of his friends jokingly said it shouldn't have been called Surprised by Joy, it should have been called Suppressed by Jack. So there are plenty of examples of his secretiveness, his guardedness. His great friend George Sayer said Jack never ceased to be secretive. So again, if we're trying to understand Lewis's character, we've got to factor in not only the fact that he was interested in complexity and consistency, but also that he had this capacity for secretiveness.
One of the things that I would toss in here, and this connects to what you've written in Planet Narnia, is that there's the personality reasons why he might have chosen to be secretive, but there are also some quite good literary reasons. Would you tell us a bit about that?
Absolutely. I mean, that is, in a way, more pertinent, because although we can show that Lewis had these secretive aspects to his personality, of course, that means nothing. That proves nothing about the Narnia Chronicles. But when we look at Lewis's literary interests, that is perhaps a little bit more relevant because, well, first of all, Lewis had this theory of kappa element in romance. He once wrote a paper with that title, and kappa is the initial letter of the Greek word krypton, which means cryptic or hidden. So the title of this paper was Hidden Element in Story, basically. That's what a cryptic element in romance translates as. The thing is, though, that this essay was never published under that title. Lewis later rewrote the essay and published it under another title called On Stories. And that's where this idea of a kind of hiddenness or cryptic element in a story is developed. And it amounts to this, that in a good story, every single thing in the story will be conspiring to achieve and communicate a particular atmosphere or flavor or tone. Lewis talks about the red skinnery of the Last of the Mohicans, for instance, and the deathliness, the deathly atmosphere of Hamlet. But the thing about these atmospheric qualities is that while you're immersed in the story, you don't actually contemplate these atmospheres. You enjoy them. You breathe them in. You are immersed in them. And so effectively, they're hidden from you. We'll come back to this, I think, in a later discussion. It's a very important aspect about Lewis's attitude as a writer.
Right. In fact, the next episode in Chapter 2 of the Narnia Code with the beam of light, that you go into some detail in that. There obviously years went by between when you were a boy until this book came out. How much time you're going to explain that Eureka moment actually in Episode 3, but give us some taste of what's going to be coming with that.
Well, yes, as I've mentioned, I had this slight sense of discomfort with the Narnia Chronicles from an early age. As I went on reading and studying C.S. Lewis more deeply over the years, the sense of discomfort only grew because, you know, as I got better acquainted with Lewis, I began to see how uncharacteristic it would have been of him to slop the books together without any keen or clear imaginative logic. I did an Oxford English degree. I wrote an undergraduate thesis on the Narnia Chronicles. I began to teach C.S. Lewis to visiting American students. I lived for 3 years in his home, the Kilns, sleeping in his bedroom and studying in his study. And all the while I was, you know, worrying away at the back of my mind over this question of the seeming lack of imaginative coherence to the Narnia Chronicles. And I even tried at one point to map out a way in which they were connected to different plays by Shakespeare, though I soon abandoned that idea. And then when I came to do my PhD on C.S. Lewis, I was looking at his theological imagination, and 18 months into my research, I suddenly had the idea that led to these books, Planet Narnia and the Narnia Code.
Well, now we're getting into the second chapter, which is the beam of light. In this podcast, while not revealing what that code is, we're kind of going along with Michael as you were reviewing, thinking through your mind about what you've learned about Lewis and how that background knowledge led up to you actually finding the Narnia Code. Now, before getting into that, let's address the issue of there's the planet Narnia, there's the Narnia Code, the book, and then there's the video. What was the order of publication for those who don't know, Michael?
The first book was Planet Narnia. That came out in 2008. That's a long and detailed account published by Oxford University Press. Then the BBC got interested and they commissioned a one-hour TV documentary about that book. That's called The Narnia Code and that's available on DVD. And then it was suggested to me that a book with the same title, The Narnia Code, should also be published as a shorter and simpler, more accessible version of Planet Narnia. And that's what came out in 2010, published in America by Tyndale House.
And Holly, what have you enjoyed in terms of like watching, reading the different material? How has that helped you?
Well, I've primarily been using Planet Narnia as part of my own academic work because I'm a literary scholar. So that's where I've primarily been working with Michael's ideas. But I've quite enjoyed the Narnia Code as really just a demonstration that these ideas are interesting and accessible to a wider audience. They're not just for literary scholars like myself, but are of interest really to anyone who is interested in Lewis. And one of the things I like quite a lot about the Narnia Code is that, like Lewis himself, Michael can write very effectively both at the academic and at the popular level, which is really a delight.
Chapter 2 is what we're dealing with today. Again, that's called The Beam of Light. And Michael, you start out where you ended the first chapter, and we didn't mention this at the end of the last episode, but you were in bed and you had your Eureka moment. However, this was only possible because for many years you studied the writings of Lewis and to help you understand his worldview. So this chapter gives the reader the necessary background, or for me, I guess I might say it's a summary, to be able to connect the dots themselves once they've read this chapter and then gone through the rest of the book. They kind of are equipped to fully appreciate it. Holly, we actually mentioned last time about the enjoyment versus contemplation, and that started with another essay. Share for the listeners about that for Michael to discuss.
Well, one of Lewis's important essays is a piece called Meditation and Toolshed, and this is where he presents ideas that he discusses elsewhere in his work about the difference between what he calls enjoyment and what he calls contemplation. But what's particularly important about this particular essay is he gives us a visual for it. He imagines that he's standing in a tool shed in the dark, and there's a beam of light coming through a crack in the ceiling. And if you look at the beam, you see certain things about it. But if you step into the light and you look along the beam, you see things entirely differently. And this becomes an image, metaphor for enjoyment and contemplation, the idea of looking at and looking along. And this is quite significant to all of what Lewis is doing, in particular for the Chronicles.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, it is a really fundamental distinction in the whole of Lewis's thought and writings, this distinction between contemplation, looking at, and enjoyment, looking along. It's a distinction that Lewis discovered in his 20s in the writings of a philosopher called Samuel Alexander, and he said that he immediately accepted this distinction as true and ever afterwards regarded it as an indispensable tool of thought. And that's no small claim coming from a man like C.S. Lewis. He thought it was absolutely indispensable to clarify whether you're looking at something, whether you're, you know, external and distanced and dispassionate, supposedly neutral, uninvolved, or whether you're looking along it, inhabiting it, immersed in it, embraced by it, committed to it, involved with it. And Lewis really divided consciousness into these two modes. It's not sufficient, he said, just to think that we have the unconscious and then we have the conscious. We need a threefold division, he said, the unconscious, contemplated, and the enjoyed. Contemplation and enjoyment, for Lewis, are two different ways in which we are conscious of things.
And this ties into how he actually, or I don't know in terms of planning it for the Narnia stories, but I guess I'm thinking from another angle that you note in terms of a challenge in terms of like writing a story where you're trying to portray Jesus. One of the things we didn't talk about last episode was there's obviously the Christian element. I guess we did talk about it at some degree, but we didn't emphasize it. There's the Christian element that's there, but it wasn't as obvious in each of the stories, and that there is a challenge when you're trying to do direct parallels to portray Jesus without saying it was him and how complicated that would get. Can you address some of that as you talk some more about the kappa element in romance?
Yes. Well, I mean, first of all, thank you for reminding me. I mean, about the kind of irregularity of the portrayal of Aslan within the Narnia Chronicles. I mean, that was another slightly bemusing, perplexing thing about the stories, that the three of the Narnia Chronicles seem to be very clearly related to biblical episodes and events. You have the gospel story in The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. You have a creation account in The Magician's Nephew, and you have a Last Judgment story in The Last Battle. And there, in those three books, the biblical parallels are all very obvious and almost explicit, you might say. But then in the other four Narnia Chronicles, although you still have Aslan, and he's still Christ-like in various ways, there's no very obvious element or episode of Christ's life or ministry being reimagined in those four books. You don't get a Narnian nativity story, for instance. You know, you might have expected that, given what Lewis has done in the first three books that I talked about. You might have expected a whole story devoted to Aslan being born into Narnia as a lion cub, for instance. You don't get that. Instead, you know, for instance, in Prince Caspian, Aslan enters the story amongst dancing trees and gives a great war cry. Now, what's that got to do with anything particularly obviously biblical? Now, I'm not saying in the slightest that these are unbiblical. I'm just saying that the biblical theology in them is much deeper and more sophisticated than simply one-to-one parallels. So anyway, that's one way of kind of setting up this problem about, you know, Lewis said that the Narnia Chronicles were all about Christ. The question is, how are they about Christ? Are they about Christ simply by drawing fairly simple one-to-one relationships between things Jesus did in the Bible and things Aslan does in Narnia, or are they more subtle than that? And obviously I'm wanting to say that they're more subtle. It's not sufficient to say that they're just based on one-to-one parallels, because only three of the books seem to be like that. So the question comes back to, you know, how are they about Christ? And this is where we've got to look more carefully at our New Testaments and realize that according to the New Testament, Jesus is much more than just the solitary, singular, historical figure called Jesus of Nazareth, who moved about the stage of the world doing things to people 2,000 years ago. And of course he is that, but he's also much more than that, because he is the Son of God. He is God the Son. He is the eternal Word coming forth from the Father, by whom all things were made, and in whom all things hold together. Now that's a very interesting and important phrase. in Christ all things hold together. That's a verse from the letter to the Colossians. And Lewis was interested in that verse and paraphrased it in one of his own books. He paraphrased it as, Christ is the all-pervasive principle of concretion or cohesion whereby the universe holds together. Now, how do you get that aspect of Christ into your story if you're wanting to write a story about Christ? I mean, it's relatively easy to have a Jesus figure who does Jesus-like things, but what about this cosmic Christ, the infinite, eternal, divine, much more obviously divine Christ? How do you get that into a story? Because that would involve everything, because in Christ all things hold together. And that's the mystery, I think, that Lewis was trying to grapple with in the way that he constructed the Narnia Chronicles.
And this actually is also why, in part, his work is so important to me as an apologist, because one of the things that appalls me is the poor quality of a lot of attempted Christian writing these days, with people who think that what Lewis did was to just sort of have a Christ character who happened to be a lion, and they try to replicate that by having stories that might or might not be fantasies with characters that are going through the motions of biblical scenes or have biblical morals. And these things are usually just dreadfully, just horrifically, catastrophically bad. And they don't help. And so what is it about Lewis's work that makes it so successful? Because my own experience has also been that it is a way in which we can come to know something more about Christ than if we were just learning information about him. So clearly his works do present Christ, and they do present him in a very powerful way, but it's not the way that most people tend to think that he does it, because when they try to do it the way they think he did it, they fail, and they fail badly. So that was one of the reasons why I was so enthusiastic about discovering Michael's ideas here, because he's traced out how does he do it that he's able to achieve this? And I think he's right.
Right, and that leads me to another aspect in this chapter, and that is Lewis is noting that besides what you were saying, Michael, about the challenge of writing a story that portrays Jesus in it, as Holly was just noting, but just in general that it is the type of kind of danger that matters and not just the level or degree of danger. In other words, just one adventure to another. And you note that Lewis didn't like the Three Musketeers. Can you tie that into what's been said?
Yes. When Lewis was writing his essay on stories, he wrote about the atmosphere or flavor of The Last of the Mohicans and said that, you know, when the hero of that story is half sleeping by his bivouac fire in the woods, while a redskin with a tomahawk is silently creeping up on him from behind, he said that what made for the essence of that scene was not just the fact that the hero was in danger, but that he was in danger from a guy wielding a tomahawk. Now, you could have substituted a crook carrying a pistol, and that would have put the hero into much greater danger. But it's not degrees of danger that really matter. It's the quality of danger. It's the kind of danger. It's the whole world to which this sort of danger belongs that is the really important point. It's a world very carefully constructed of all sorts of, you know, small and seemingly unimportant points, but which conspire to give the required atmosphere. It's a world constructed out of things like snowshoes and canoes and wigwams and feathered headdresses and war paint and Hiawatha names and, yes, tomahawks, not pistols. Pistols don't really belong in that world. So what Fenimore Cooper gives us access to in The Last of the Mohicans is this atmosphere of what Lewis called red skinnery. It's rather unfortunate, his politically incorrect terminology from the 1940s, but that's the term he used. We breathe the red skin atmosphere in The Last of the Mohicans. Whereas in a book like The Three Musketeers, he said there's no real prevailing atmosphere. There's no emotional weather to the story. The characters go from London to Paris, and there's no sense that Paris is any different from London. It's just a bucket load of plot, one darn thing after another in this story, and it's all very exciting and adventurous, but it's not the sort of world you want to go back to because it has no coherent flavor or tone. The reason we go back to our favorite stories, Lewis argues, is because they have this It's kind of a spirit of a place, really. It's like we go back to our favourite places, because we like the Londonness of London, he says, or the Donegality of Donegal, which was one of his favourite places in Ireland. It's difficult to put these things into words, but everybody who's got any sensitivity can recognise that a particular place has its own particular spirit, and a particular book, a good book, will have its own particular tone or flavour or feel. And so that's what Lewis valued, particularly in imaginative fiction. As a literary critic, he writes about that very explicitly. And so when it comes to the writing of the Narnia Chronicles, we can expect him to practice what he preached. We can expect him to try to evoke a coherent atmosphere or flavour in the Narnia Chronicles themselves.
Well, one of the things that we do enjoy in the Chronicles of Narnia is that sense of atmosphere, and what will be unfolding over the next few episodes in the series is what it is that allowed Lewis to create this coherent atmosphere. So we can look forward to unfolding that in a bit more detail. Well, welcome to our podcast series on the Narnia Code. This is part 3 of a 12-part series on Dr. Michael Ward's book. This is Dr. Holly Ordway speaking, and we are co-hosting with William O'Flaherty from EssentialCSLewis.com. And so this episode, the third in our series, is on the seven heavens. So, William, I think you wanted to start off with an interesting quote from Alan Jacobs about Michael's work.
Yes, in the Narnia Code, we have several different endorsements that is actually regarding planet Narnia. But Alan Jacobs, who is a professor of English from Wheaton College, he's also the author of The Narnian, a biography on the life and imagination of C.S. Lewis. He says, noting Michael Ward's claim that he has discovered the secret imaginative key to the Narnia books, the sensitive reader responds by erecting a castle of skepticism. My own castle was gradually but utterly demolished as I read this thoughtful, scholarly, and vividly written book. Now, Michael, I want to pitch to you, for people at this point who are still skeptical about your claim to having found the Narnia Code, what would you say to them?
I think I would say you're quite right to be skeptical, because it's a very large claim that I'm making. You know, I'm arguing that Lewis invented and then kept a significant imaginative secret about the Chronicles. And so, you know, that's a large claim, and anybody who hears it and is skeptical is right to be skeptical, because, you know, it sounds rather unlikely. It sounds rather implausible. I would be skeptical myself if someone else made the claim. But all I can do is present the evidence, ask you to consider the evidence with an open mind, and see where it leads you. And that's, I'm pleased to say, what Alan Jacobs did. He read the book and found it persuasive.
We're going to begin chapter. Chapter 3 picks back up with that eureka moment that was mentioned in chapter 1.
So I was lying in bed in 2003, I think it was, when I was halfway through my PhD on Lewis's theological imagination. And I was reading a long poem that Lewis wrote about the seven heavens. It's simply called The Planets. And when I got to the lines about Jupiter in this poem, I did a double take, because the seven heavens, according to medieval thought, had a set of qualities and influences that were felt on Earth. And one of Jupiter's influences was this, according to the poem, that Jupiter brought about winter past and guilt forgiven. And that was the little kind of, that was the loose thread, you might say, that I tugged on, and which, when tugged upon, unraveled and revealed the whole tapestry, I believe, that Lewis was weaving in his construction of the Narnia Chronicles.
So, Michael, it probably would be helpful at this point if you outlined briefly for us the seven heavens as they're seen in medieval cosmology, noting that, as Lewis would have commented and would have observed, that we don't have to believe that these are actual properties of the planets to understand that they're a really coherent and interesting and useful symbolic system value to us presently as well. So if you could should briefly outline that.
Yeah, well, it's worth remembering that C.S. Lewis, although he's best known for the writing of the Narnia Chronicles and for other books like The Screwtape Letters and Mere Christianity, he wasn't professionally a writer of fiction, and he wasn't professionally a writer of books about Christianity. Professionally, of course, he was an academic, and he taught here at Oxford for nearly 30 years, and he finished his career at Cambridge, where he was professor of medieval and Renaissance literature. And as a medieval scholar, he obviously spent huge amounts of time immersing himself in the literature and the thought, and indeed in the cosmology, of the Middle Ages. And we tend to have forgotten all this now. We have an entirely different view of the cosmos from what they had back then. But back then, they believed that the Earth was the center of everything, that the Earth was static, still, and surrounded by a series of concentric spheres or heavens, each with its own planet, seven concentric spheres surrounding Earth, and each planet had its own attributes and influences which it shed upon the Earth, upon people, upon events, and even upon the metals in the Earth's crust. And this was a very carefully worked out cosmological scheme that was, it was all accepted science. It wasn't superstitious or mythical. It was hard fact until the 16th century that this was how the universe was. And Christian theologians too accepted that the planets had influences. Of course they had influences and spiritual significance because the heavens are telling the glory of God, according to the words of Psalm 19, which incidentally was C.S. Lewis's favorite psalm. And Lewis, writing about this old view of the cosmos, said that the planets as conceived in medieval thought had a permanent value as spiritual symbols. And indeed, he said it was especially worthwhile in our own generation. He thought that these seven planets divided spiritual qualities up into a sevenfold spectrum, which was very useful and indeed still the sort of divisions into which the human imagination would naturally fall. He regarded them as archetypes, you know, permanently present in the human mind and imagination. And some of the archetypes, like those of Saturn and Venus, still had a very continuing life in the modern imagination, he said, but others, like Jupiter and Mercury, we'd almost forgotten. And so Lewis thought of his own role as an academic, in large part, as a rehabilitator or as a continuer of this old understanding, because he felt that if we completely allowed it to be forgotten, we wouldn't properly understand the literature of the Middle Ages. We wouldn't understand Dante. We wouldn't understand Chaucer. And as a scholar, of course, you know, he wanted to keep that old literature alive.
Now, one of the things that you talk about in this chapter is, in terms of this old view, is that there's obviously more than seven planets or seven heavens. Tell us what you address regarding that.
Well, yes. I mean, since the time of Copernicus in the middle of the 16th century, this old view of the cosmos has been steadily discarded. Copernicus theorized that we don't actually live in a geocentric cosmos with the Earth static and central. We live in a heliocentric system, with the sun at the center, and we go around the sun. The sun doesn't go around us. And as the telescope was invented in about 1610, and as new discoveries were made, it was found that there were many more planets than seven, and that the sun wasn't indeed a planet, neither was the moon, as everyone had previously believed. Uranus was discovered, and Neptune was discovered, Pluto was discovered, became a planet, and then was relegated to a dwarf planet just a few years ago, wasn't it? And you might ask, why was C.S. Lewis so persistently interested in the old pre-Copernican cosmos, given that it had been shown to be factually incorrect? And the answer to that question is that he thought that it was symbolically valuable, because that old view of the cosmos still retained an awareness that planets and stars had some kind of spiritual significance, that they somehow spoke of God. The heavens are telling the glory of God. The firmament proclaims his handiwork. Psalm 19 again. Whereas in the modern view of the cosmos, We now think of the stars and the planet as just so many large balls of rock and gas floating about up there without any spiritual bearing upon us, without any kind of revelatory capacity to them. That's why there's that very interesting exchange in the Voyage of the Dawn Treader. You remember when Eustace and Edmund meet this star character called Ramandu, and one of them says, in our world, a star is just a huge ball of flaming gas. And the star replies and says, even in your world, that's not what a star is, but only what it's made of. In other words, it's a mistake to reduce the significance of planets simply to their material components, their constituent parts. It's all very well and useful to know that the stars are made of so much carbon and nitrogen and whatever it may be, but once you've said that, have you said everything that there is to be said about the heavens, the planets? Is that what they are? Or is it just what they are made of? It's just what they're made of. And what they are is actually, according to the scriptures, what they are is divine messengers. They're telling the glory of God. That's the deeper truth about the heavens. And that's a truth that was more readily accessible in pre-Copernican times. So that was one of the main reasons that Lewis wanted to retain an awareness of that old scheme and that old system.
And I think this is particularly important because in the post-Enlightenment culture that we are in, there's been this sense of a division between those two things. And an increasing, this is something that Lewis addresses in the essay we talked about earlier, Meditation in a Toolshed and other places, the idea that in the modern world, we have become convinced that looking at something is the only valid way, that we look at a star and say so much carbon, so much helium, etc., and then we're done. But Lewis's larger point, which I believe is correct, is that there is the other aspect, there is another way of knowing, the looking along, and this isn't simply a case of, oh, let's go back and look at how the medievals thought about the world, how interesting in a literary sense. No, this is the way that we now, in 2012, ought to be looking at the world with the both and. Mm. And that's part of the reason that his work has enduring significance.
Absolutely, yeah. We should think of the stars not just objectively and kind of scientifically, neutrally standing outside them and looking at them, but we should realize that we are in a relationship with them, that they and we are both creatures of the divine creator. Naturally, men and women are different from stars and planets, but we are all creatures. We are all part of God's creation, and we are interlinked. We are related to each other in a marvelous whole in which each part has significance for every other part. And that's the Christian vision of the cosmos, which Lewis is wanting to reawaken in the modern imagination.
And this will be something that in episode 4 we're going to look specifically. It kicks off where we're going to go book by book in the Chronicles of Narnia and look how which one relates to which planet or which star in the heavens as it was viewed. But one of the things I think that might be most useful wrapping up is you share about three main reasons Lewis loved the pre-Copernican cosmos. Can you share some aspects of that?
Well, he valued it, as I've mentioned, for its literary importance. If we don't understand that old cosmos, then how will we understand one of the greatest poems of the Middle Ages, The Divine Comedy by Dante? Because in The Divine Comedy, the pilgrim mounts up through the seven heavens in his ascent to God's throne. So that's one purely literary reason why Lewis was interested in it. Another was, as I've already mentioned, that Lewis had a great fondness for Psalm 19, the heavens are telling the glory of God. That was in part because Lewis was himself a keen amateur astronomer. He had a telescope on the balcony of his bedroom. He liked visiting the local observatory. He paid a good deal of attention to the stars above his head, not just the stars as they were written about in old literature. He was often found to be pointing out unusual conjunctions of the planets to his friends and people he was writing letters to. And then as a Bible-believing Christian too, Lewis realized that in the scriptures, that there are these, not just in Psalm 19, but throughout the Bible, there is this view of the heavens as meaningful and significant for us. We tend to think of astrology as necessarily a bad thing, something dangerous, maybe occult. And of course, there is an aspect of astrology which can be very misleading. If you think that the stars are controlling you, or if the stars deserve your worship, then that kind of astrology is much to be avoided, of course. But there's a long tradition of good astrology, most notably, of course, in the wise men who come to Bethlehem. We have seen his star in the east, and we have come to worship him, they say. But the wise men from the east were astrologers. They were good astrologers. Their astrology led them to worship Christ. And Lewis was well aware of that scriptural tradition, and that was another thing that he was wanting to reawaken in the modern imagination, I think.
Right. Well, this gives us a bit of an overview of the seven heavens, and I will note that something we'll probably touch on later, that Lewis did not just use this planetary imagery in the Chronicles of Narnia, but in fact it appears in other works of his, most notably the books that are called the Space Trilogy or the Cosmic Trilogy or the Ransom Trilogy, depending on one's taste. And so we'll talk more in detail about probably those and about the individual planets as we carry on in the rest of the series.
And so that's how the third episode ended, with my co-host Dr. Holly Ordway and Dr. Michael Ward, author of The Narnia Code and other books. Next time, I'll just combine the fourth and fifth shows, where the first two published books on Narnia are discussed. I'm William O'Flaherty. Thank you for listening to All About Jack, a podcast feature of EssentialCSLewis.com. I'm the creator of that website and the author of the forthcoming C.S. Lewis Goes to Hell, a companion and study guide to the Screwtape Letters. Learn more about it by visiting ScrewtapeCompanion.com. Be sure to check the show notes for links to websites about Planet Narnia, the Narnia Code, and Dr. Ward's personal site. I'll also have a link to an essay chat he did with me on a shorter work entitled Myth Became Fact. The show notes also include a link to Holly's personal website, and then I also provide a link that searches the website for three episodes that Holly has been on with me, including to talking about Not God's Type, her autobiography, and two essay chats. You can find the show notes by either going to EssentialCSLewis.com or allaboutjack.podbean.com. The Podbean location is where the podcast files are directly hosted. Podbean is spelled P-O-D-B-E-A-N. Again, that's allaboutjack.podbean.com. If you go to the other location, EssentialCSLewis.com, you can still get to this podcast, plus I have a variety of other articles there as well. I hope you enjoyed today's show enough to want to share it. Also, feel free to leave comments about the program online and consider listening to other shows. My most recent new shows include interviews with book authors. One was with the editor of C.S. Lewis and His Circle, and the other one was with Dr. Diana Glyer on her book Bandersnatch. Past shows include a conversation with Colin Duryea about the Oxford Inklings. Again, you can hear those podcasts by either going to EssentialCSLewis.com or allaboutjack.podbean.com. If you have questions or comments, you can email me, info@EssentialCSLewis.com. Again, that email address is info@EssentialCSLewis.com. Finally, did you know that you can help make sure this podcast is freely available to all? Consider becoming a financial supporter of this podcast to make sure it continues. There's a link in the show notes about this. Contributions can be as little as a dollar a month. There are some great rewards possible, and no long-term commitment is necessary.